Okay, hello.
Hello. Oh my gosh, that was quite
a long day.
Oh, so normally we are recording in beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia, but today
we are in Edmonton, Alberta, in my father's house.
Yes, because we're actually here for the Edmonton International Film Festival. Today was the opening gala.
In a couple of days, The Devil and I will be making its world premiere.
Yeah.
So today's Ariel's episode.
Yes, yes. So today I actually chose a topic that turned out to be pretty appropriate because we flew to Edmonton from the Abbotsford Airport rather than the Vancouver Airport. And today's topic is the Abbotsford Killer.
Oh, dope.
Yeah, and so this is actually our first listener-suggested episode. We got this topic suggestion from Instagram user NolanEaston003.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nolan.
Yeah, thank you, Nolan. This is pretty cool. So, fun fact.
Yeah.
Start us off. So, back in the 90s, Abbotsford had the highest homicide rate for a city of its size in the country.
Oh, God.
There's a lot of gang violence there.
But it's so far away from everything.
I mean, they like to call themselves the city within the country now, so...
Yeah.
With being a city comes city problems.
That makes sense.
Now, do you want me to tell you who the killer is first, or do you want me to wait until the very end to tell you the name and a little bit about him?
Is it like a twist? Is there like a huge plot twist in giving the name? Is it a better narrative that you hold it back?
I mean, most of this is about trying to catch the person, so maybe it's a better narrative. I just don't want to copy one of my sources because they say who it is in the beginning, but then they like... I listened to Dark Poutine.
Yeah.
And they did like a two-parter on this guy.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. So it was like the first episode was... all the investigation, and then the second was the trial and getting into who that dude is. So would you like me to reveal it or not?
Sure, reveal it.
Yeah. So, the person behind today's terrible tale is a man named Terry Driver.
That's a funny name.
So, when I saw the name, I thought it was going to be a woman.
Yeah.
Like a woman who murdered, but no, it was a man.
Terry Driver.
Terry.
Oh.
Terry Driver. Harry's not a very common woman's name.
No.
No. Also, preface this all. I've had maybe like 2 or 3 hours of sleep today, and we're now at like 11:30
at night. But we're dedicated.
Yes. We make sure we bring you the best content we can. So, Terry Driver, he worked at the Abbotsford Printing Company at the time, which was 1995 is when everything we talk about in this episode happens. He also had a wife and 2 children. As well, he was the son of a decorated police officer.
Oh, man. So,
that's who this dude is.
We're talking like Dexter Morgan type stuff here.
Yeah? Is that TV show?
Yes.
Okay.
Dexter Morgan.
I didn't...
Son of... adopted son of, like, Harry. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Apparently, Terry Driver originally wanted to join the police and stuff and did that creepy serial killer thing of really trying to cozy up to them when he got rejected and from it and everything. So...
Do you know why he got rejected?
He's got a lot of behavioral issues in his childhood and stuff and...
Priors?
Yeah. But then not getting convicted or anything, or like not having it pushed any further.
All right.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So now we're going to shift from there to Friday, the 13th of October, 1995.
Nice.
Yeah. So Tanya Smith and Misty Cockrell, they were, you know, having a fun night. They started at a party in Surrey, and then they... didn't want to go home yet, and they weren't at their curfew yet, so they decided to go to a birthday party in Abbotsford, and they were walking that way, and these are 2 16-year-old girls. We're not talking, like,
yeah,
adult women.
1995. Yeah. Surrey to Abbotsford seems pretty far.
They're kind of, like, I'm guessing it was the farthest edge of Surrey. And then maybe they got a ride.
All right. Regardless.
They got a ride part of the way, maybe, but they had to walk to the actual house. And while they were walking to the party, I think they actually got really close to it. And then they were grabbed by a man with a bat.
No.
Driver.
Yeah.
and he pulled them into the bushes. They happened to be near their school.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Close to home. So he was, like, being threatening and everything. At one point, he puts down the bat for some reason, and then Misty grabs the bat and hits him with it, which makes him focus on her, so he gets the bat away from her, and then he keeps beating her and beating her until she's unconscious. So that's what happens to Misty. She received such massive damage to her head that if it had been left untreated, she would have died. But
survived.
Yeah. Luckily, she managed to, like, drag herself to the hospital after she woke up.
Oh.
Yeah. So she was in the hospital, coming in and out of consciousness, life-saving surgery happening, but she's still fighting for her life in the hospital.
Yeah.
Apparently it was, like, almost like there was a hole in her skull.
That would make sense after Oh, God.
It gets worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you'd expect. The next day, there was some people, like, down at this river fishing and stuff, and they found a body in the river, and it was Misty's friend Tanya that she'd been walking with.
Oh, so she didn't make it.
No.
Same cause of death? Beating by...
So, actually, her cause of death, she was beaten, she was sexually assaulted, her clothes were, like, taken off of her body and then thrown on top of bushes so that, like, they could be seen. And then her cause of death wasn't actually the beatings, it was being put face down in the river while unconscious and drowning.
No, drowning's, like, the worst way to die.
Set on fire, I feel like, might be worse.
They're both pretty bad.
Yeah.
I don't think I want to have to compare.
Very true. I don't want to ever experience either. So, Tanya's body, yeah, they found it. They were able to get DNA from a semen sample on the body. And meanwhile, Misty's in the hospital. There's, like, police sitting at her bedside with a notebook, just waiting for her to wake up so they can...
ask questions.
Get as much knowledge as they can. And then... she was eventually able to talk to them enough for them to make a composite sketch.
Yeah.
So they sort of had something to go off of for trying to find the guy. Then this is when the weird stuff starts to happen.
Weird stuff.
Weird stuff. This isn't just a cut and dry murder, because the first thing that happens is that they set up this tip line.
Yeah.
And then they get a call from a man claiming that he was the one who drove Misty to the hospital. But Misty hadn't been driven to the hospital.
She walked.
And stumbled and crawled.
Ugh.
Yeah. Now, a few days later, they received another phone call. This time they were sure that it was from the killer, because in the phone call, he said, "Just to let you know who I am, Tanya's right nipple tasted really good."
Ew.
And this is what made them definitely know it was the killer, because there had been a bite mark on Tanya's right nipple, but they had never made that information available to the public, so it had to be someone who had intimate knowledge of it.
Alright, so he's attacked these girls, and now he's playing with the police.
Yeah, and so the police were able to trace this phone call, and they traced it to a payphone made that was outside of the MSA arena, but they didn't get there in time, and they couldn't find any fingerprints on the payphone.
Because he's interested in the police.
Yep, and his daddy's a decorated cop.
So he knows. Well, everybody knows. They're gonna look for fingerprints, wear gloves.
So funny that you would say that, because only hours later, a 911 call was received, and in the call, he said, "Do you think I would be stupid enough to leave fingerprints behind when I make a phone call?" And this time it was untraceable.
Yeah. Oh.
But that also suggests that he may have stayed in the area after he makes these phone calls to watch the police trying to figure things out, because he knew that they dusted for fingerprints and didn't find anything.
I see. Clever. So they do they set the trap?
We're not that far yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then a mere 20 minutes later, there was a call to the tip line again. And this time he said, "I'm the one. I'm giving you the chance to try and find me. I'll be cruising around looking for someone else." This was another traceable call, and it led to a phone booth outside of an old grocery store at Ventura Plaza. Again, no one there when they got there, and no fingerprints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Predictably.
Yeah. Now he's, like, starting to threaten to do more.
Which places a huge target on him.
Yeah. So then on October 20th, the composite sketch...
October 20th, so we're a week after the initial attack.
Yeah. And the composite sketch was released to the public, as well as the fact that the killer had been making contact with the police. So people knew that the killer was calling the police. They didn't know what he was saying, but they just know that fact. But kind of
what he looks like.
What the composite sketch looks like, yeah. We'll get into that later. So now there started to be rumors going around that there was going to be another attack on Halloween. Either that, or that the killer was going to choose that night to make contact with the police again.
Well, I mean, it makes sense. He's dramatic. He's...
Yep. And he followed through on that because he called from yet another payphone to the police, but once again, they got to it too late.
Yep.
Yep. So, eventually, the police actually took the phone calls that the killer made, because they had recordings of all of them, and they made them public. So, put them on the news, people could hear them.
And maybe they could identify his voice.
Exactly. But this mostly just caused a panic within the community. And Abbotsford's like this... like
very it's, small.
Yeah, it's the Bible Belt of BC, or the Fraser Valley is, so yeah. That's like... the kind of community... my aunt actually lives there.
Yeah,
Lots of farms.
My friend who's come out to Edmonton with us, she
Works there. Yeah, it's getting bigger, that's for sure.
Probably since 1995.
Oh, yeah. So, because of the content of the phone calls and the killer still being at large, Misty and her family actually got placed in witness protection. Oh. Like, in the witness protection program, because... she's their star witness, and they didn't want anything to happen to her or her family, because that could, like, put a serious wrench in their case when they do find the guy.
We should also mention that Hell's Angels would have been kind of active at this time.
Yeah, that never came up in the research I was able to find.
No?
No, but sure.
Witness protection.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. They then did another composite sketch, which actually led them to a suspect that a bunch of people called in were like, looks like this dude. And he had like a bit of a history with the police, so they brought him in, and he was held in custody for 2 months before he was cleared, man. Because his DNA didn't match.
Oh, well, DNA is a bit more reliable than a composite sketch.
Yep.
But 2 months it took.
Yeah, well, this is the 90s, so like...
you have to send it away to labs for testing.
Yeah, and it's gonna take a while.
All right.
Yeah. So you mentioned, did the police put out a trap?
Yeah.
They did.
Yes!
It's not a big one, but they released this false news story that, like, basically saying that a psychologist said that they were never gonna find the killer because the killer had given up and had left town, and the killer had lost his nerve.
They're baiting him. He's gonna be dramatic.
Oh boy, is he ever. So this trap worked because the next day, or not the next day, but soon after, the killer left a gift at one of the local radio stations.
Oh gosh, this is like totally Red Dragon.
Yeah. Someone called into the radio station and said, check the Max car in the parking lot. When the DJ went out to check the car, he found Tanya Smith's headstone on the hood of the car.
Oh, gross.
And it had all of these threats against Misty and her family written all over it.
Oh.
Good thing she was put in a witness protection program.
Yeah. Oh, that's so dramatic.
Yeah. Which also led to another 911 call. How'd you like my present I gave you guys, huh? This time they traced it to a payphone at Rotary Stadium, which is 2 blocks from police headquarters. Uh-oh. And the police are pretty sure that they missed him by, like, mere seconds.
I can imagine the film. I can imagine if this was a film.
Oh, yeah, this would make a good movie.
Please call. David Fincher, get on this.
Yeah. So, the next thing he did is he just, like, went and stood on the front lawn of some random house he picked, and then he broke the front window with a wrench. and he had taped a letter to it, which was addressed to the police. And in that letter, he confessed to, like, at least 3 more sexual assaults, I believe.
Yeah.
And he wasn't just making stuff up, because he included details about these sexual assaults that the police had on record that, like, the public didn't really know about. So, yeah. But this is also one of the ways that he screwed up, because the tape that was used with the letter had a fingerprint on it.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So they were able to finally get a fingerprint. And then shortly after, the next domino in the chain fell down. You know what a domino is, right?
I know what a domino is.
Oh, that was a funny show. Sorry, Topher was watching Norseman on the plane and I watched it over his shoulder.
And they had to explain dominoes because Vikings.
Yeah, they didn't know what dominoes were. So a mother and son were listening to the news, and I guess they played the recordings of the phone calls again, and they both recognized the voice as that of their son/brother,
Terry Driver. Yes!
Yeah, and so, just like, Unabomber, was that Kuklinski? I think the Unabomber was Kuklinski. But anyways, just like in that, his own family
turned on him.
Yeah, for the greater good, man.
Yeah, for the good of society.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah. So now, here's also where we get into the whole composite sketch thing, because Terry Driver did not resemble the composite sketch at all.
No.
No. But the officers, like, took this tip that they'd received very seriously, and so they kept watch outside of his house until he got home from work, and then they came up, knocked on the door, and said that they'd had a call come in connecting him to the composite sketch, which he then replied saying that he didn't look like it, but they'd planned for that. So they said that they were asking everyone who was identified by anyone to submit to DNA test, fingerprints, or a polygraph test.
Yeah.
And Terry refused all 3.
I mean, if you're guilty, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, that's like, that's pretty big red flags of being guilty, because if you're innocent, just be like,
yeah, this will check clear
my DNA. Check my DNA. Just like that other guy got cleared because of the DNA.
Yeah.
You know? So he then eventually consulted his lawyer and decided that he was going to cooperate with the police, but he wouldn't provide DNA. He was only going to provide fingerprints as long as they'd be destroyed after the comparison was made, so the police couldn't keep them in their system.
That's on purpose.
Yep.
Red flag for sure.
Yep. But, you see, luckily the public didn't know that the police had found a fingerprint. So yeah. He probably thought, oh yeah, they're not going to match it to anything. And then, after they do their comparisons, they'll get destroyed, so you're never going to find anything to link me to this. Exactly. But the print was a match.
And lo and behold,
yeah,
Terry Driver was guilty of assaults.
And murder.
And murder.
Mostly the murder.
Murder.
Yeah, but he was arrested on the spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
So then in the trial, he was found guilty not only of the murder, but in some later trials, he was also found guilty of the assaults that he confessed to in his letter. He has been classified as a dangerous offender, and he could be held in prison indefinitely.
What did he get sentenced to?
Oh, I think it was like...
Well, I guess murder is 25 to life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then by being identified as a dangerous offender, then that, like, strips your right for parole.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, and so Misty Cockrell survived. Apparently, like, she had issues ever since, like, physical issues ever since.
Oh.
But I did watch a documentary that interviewed her, and so she, at least, like, in the 90s, it was only a few years, maybe a couple of years after all this happened, she was at least seeming, like, okay, and apparently she's done victims' rights, activism and stuff, and outreach and everything, and working with victims. So she's turned it into a make the world a better place thing.
That's always so nice to hear.
Yeah, and of course she also testified in
court
against him. And, like, apparently when asked why he didn't look like the composite sketch. She was like, he might not look like it, but there's this evil look within his eye that I'll never forget.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So I didn't quite have as much time to research this as I would have liked because we had to go away.
Yeah.
But
planning our trip.
Yeah, it's a bit crazy. So I had two sources for this. The first one is the Dark Poutine podcast that I mentioned.
Yeah.
Which, if you found this interesting, check out their two-part series on it, because one of the hosts actually has some interesting connections to the case.
Oh.
Yeah. And then I also found a documentary on YouTube that someone had bootlegged. So it was just like, the title was like, The Abbotsford Killer, Terry Driver Murder Documentary or something like that. And it's like, that's not the actual documentary's title. And I think they may have cut it off. And then I tried watching the credits, but they were really fast. But I did see it was a Canadian documentary with a British narrator. But yeah, so...
So YouTube has a documentary, Dark Poutine podcast. Excellent stuff.
Yeah, and that is the Abbotsford Killer.
Oh man, that's really fun. Yeah. I didn't know that Abbotsford had like somebody who would go and like taunt the police.
I know. Yeah. So thank you for this suggestion again, Nolan.
Nolan.
It was very, very handy to point us in this direction because it's definitely an interesting case.
If you guys have more suggestions, get at us. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
BadCookiePictures@gmail.com if email is your thing.
We have a website.
We have a Patreon.
We have a Pinterest account.
We have a Patreon. Yeah. If you become a patron, then you'll get a shout out on this podcast at some point. And you also get other really cool stuff.
Exclusives.
Yeah. And so... We mentioned that right now we are in Edmonton for the Edmonton International Film Festival.
You know what we can announce now?
Can we? Have they announced it? Have they announced it yet?
No.
I don't want to say... Away. I know we're a week ahead of time, but I just don't want to say anything in case they don't.
Okay. But check our Facebook page for updates on festivals, especially if you're in the Vancouver
area. Yeah, and then also, like, I guess this week, we've got Women in Horror Film Festival, we've got the, whatchamacallit, Monsters of Film, which is in Sweden, that's going to be Nepenthe's European premiere.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think Sick Chick Flicks is actually happening right now, this weekend coming up. It'll be done by the time this comes out. Yeah, anything else we should chit-chatter? Oh, my head hurts from this lack of sleep.
Yeah. Very sorry.
That's no one's fault, because I had to work late.
Yeah.
So.
But we made it.
Yes.
We got to tell you our wicked story.
Yes, and now I get to go to bed.
Yes. All right. Yes. As always, stay creepy.